just when you thought it was safe to take down your jack-o'-lantern, the spooky season returns. But not just any spookum, a genre-defining one. Because two horror fans, and the occasional special guest, refuse to let evil die tonight. Welcome to the Apocalypse Video Halloween Retrospective. I am your slightly less creepy narrator, David Snyder. Tonight, we discuss the original 1978 John Carpenter classic, Halloween. The film that set the stage for the slasher-filled decade to follow and would inadvertently make William Shatner's face the thing of nightmares.
Next.
Michael Audrey Myers shall be tried as an adult for the murder of his sister, Judith Margaret Myers.
You fooled him, haven't you, Mike? But not me.
It's a holiday you'll remember forever.
Halloween night is when people play tricks on each other.
What about the boogeyman?
Death has come to your little town, Sheriff.
Seasons don't feel right. Nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain.
Boogeyman.
Donald Pleasance.
As a matter of fact, it was.
In a film by John Carpenter.
Oh no.
Halloween. Next.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Apocalypse Video Shocktober Spook. Oh, wait a minute. This isn't Shocktober, it's
December.
In Morton Hoof, what is happening? That's right. It is not Shocktober. It is
December.
But we had to keep this thing going, man. I'm your host, Dave. I'm joined again by Ruler of the Wasteland and the narrator of the Shocktober Spooktacular intro, Morton Hoof.
Hello.
And we just couldn't get enough shocks, specifically Halloween. There was a bit of a discussion around the store, just to give you some background. There's a bit of a discussion, as there was among the Wasteland, from people who were able to hear rumblings of this movie coming out in, alternate dimensions, as it happens, as that does. But Halloween Ends, the final film in the David Gordon Green trilogy of revisionist sequels, came out in a parallel dimension, and it kind of started like a big hubbub. There was a lot of controversy around it. As far, when I say controversy, I mean there was a discourse. Like, people either hated it or didn't like it. There wasn't a lot of people who enjoyed it, and that kind of got some discussion going around the store, particularly between me and Morton Hoof, aka Nick. And it was revealed that Nick, you've only seen the first three Halloween movies.
That's right.
The original three.
Yeah. The Trinity.
And I wanted to have a big discussion right then, but as it happens so often around the store, someone says, "Save it for the podcast." So, my first question to you, as we get into arguably one of the greatest horror movies ever made. I don't know if that's really up for discussion. I think that's just sort of a fact at this point. You are, to give a little background on Nick, for anyone who isn't aware, obviously everyone who listens to the show knows you love Power Rangers and whatnot, but you are also kind of a big horror fan. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not a fanatic, but I am a fan for sure. I think my tastes are pretty eclectic, as you know, everything from art house to giant monsters in rubber suits. to horror. My tastes are all over the place, but I definitely have a very big portion of my collection is horror, for sure. And I'm definitely a big horror fan. And as you said, Halloween is certainly one of the best.
So I'm kind of curious, you said your taste is eclectic. Was there a reason why you only made it up to three and didn't dive into the rest of the Halloween sequels?
Just the prioritization of time, really. I mean, it's like most of those most of the franchises, horror franchises specifically, whether it's Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, I would prioritize seeing maybe the first one to get understand, you know, because typically in these franchises, seems like most often, more often than not, the original first one or two are mostly the best regarded in the series most of the time. And so, you know, I try to, you know, prioritize the ones that I know will actually be pretty good. And then the other ones, you know, if they ever, you know, pop, make their way on into my Blu-ray player or whatever, you know, I'm definitely not like averse to seeing these, but they just get less prioritization.
You don't want to have to sift through a bunch of bullshit. You want to get to the cream of the crop, like, right away.
Yeah, I mean, unless I'm talking, like, with friends or something like that, or we're watching it together, you know, then it's a little bit of a different story. But seeking out the, you know, I don't even know how many, off the top of my head, I don't even know how many Halloween movies there are. But, like, I don't know, like, oh, Halloween 6, that's the one I really need to see. So
I think with the recent release of Halloween Ends, I think it's up to 13 now, which is ironic. It beat Friday the 13th for 13 installments.
As of this moment.
As of now. I mean, time is weird in the wasteland, as we always say. But I think it's funny that Halloween, the movie that started off the whole slasher genre and all that. Well, I guess we can get into that now. Halloween, kicking off the slasher genre, I think it's I mean, some people like will say that Psycho technically kicked off the slasher genre, but honestly, I think it was really Halloween. I mean, there was like a good 18 years between Psycho and Halloween, and you can't tell me that there was like any Friday the 13th-esque type slasher movies in that timeline. I feel like Psycho laid the seeds, and Halloween was like the beautiful pumpkin that sprouted up from that and began this whole slasher genre. Because if it wasn't for Halloween coming out, I don't think you would have Friday the 13th and all that, because from the lips of the filmmakers, Friday the 13th is straight up just a ripoff of Halloween.
Yeah, I think Halloween is definitely the big one, the one that everybody knows. I might argue that Black Christmas is a precedent, but not necessarily like not necessarily being the one that, you know, put slasher, like if you say to someone, any random person on the street, you know what a slasher movie is, you know, they do have something in mind. And I think Halloween is probably the biggest contributor to something like that. So I definitely think it's like the behemoth of this genre.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Black Christmas too. John Carpenter has said that the opening intro of Halloween with like the first person was like taken from Black Christmas, which also had a first person. In that movie, you actually see a guy like first person point of view scaling like a building, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, just it's not a Black Christmas episode, but that is also one of my favorite horror movies as well. And
oh, really? Oh, yeah, the original, I take it.
Yeah, the original. So that's definitely, I think that's on par with Halloween, if to be frank. But but yeah, so I think, but Halloween, you know, we watched it just again. I mean, you've seen, I know you've seen this a million times. I haven't seen it nearly as many times, but there is not only a presence on the screen as far as Michael Myers goes, but there's a presence the movie really has that is just very, you don't get a movie like this. It just walks forward with something that is greater than itself, it almost feels like.
Well, it's really just the atmosphere this movie creates. I think that was one thing. I mean, I from a little bit of background on my experience with Halloween, you and I were discussing this a little bit off mic, but I think in like along with Star Wars, this might be one of the movies I have seen the most in my life. I was thinking about it, and it was kind of interesting sitting down to watch this, because it's like, for a movie that you've seen so many times, I was going into it thinking like, does it have the same impact on me? Like, you know, obviously I can recognize it's a great movie, but it's like, you know, you can only have that first experience like one time, you know what I mean? And that sort of diminishes the more you watch it. And you and I were discussing, like, I rewatch movies way more than you do. So it wasn't as big a problem for you, but it was a question I had going into this. And I got to say, like, the thing that struck me was, well, like we were saying, the atmosphere of this movie. Like, I've seen it a million times, but somehow, and maybe it's just watching it with someone else that might have helped a little bit. But the atmosphere this movie creates, like, especially after the opening sequence, like, I shouldn't say the opening, the post-title sequence, like, with Dr. Loomis and Michael Myers escaping. And then it's raining, it's thunder, the music's going dee-dee-dee-dee, you know, and then it all quiets down. And then the title card comes up, Haddonfield, Halloween. And you just see, like, a few little leaves falling on the ground, and it's kind of like an overcast day. And then the music slowly comes in. And again, it's just that atmosphere that is just you can't really beat it. I don't know. Like, as far as horror movies go, like, this movie creates such a good atmosphere that it's hard to match.
Oh yeah, and definitely the ingredients here are firing on all cylinders. And I mean, that was, I think this movie is really scary. It's super creepy. I mean, half the time you don't know if the camera is, you know, from the point of view of Michael Myers, or it's just, you know, regular us audience member looking. But there are so many things going on here that's just like, and it's such a simple story, such a simple movie, yeah, relatively speaking, but the atmosphere is so thick. It really elicits, like, I don't know, a strong emotional connection, at least for me. It's just like, I was so engaged watching this. I mean, this is certainly not the first time I've seen it, but it still works just as well as the first time for me. It's just like, you know, this is the movie, like the horror movie of, this is the slasher movie, you know, this is the enemy that's coming for you. You know, the first thing that I have a very fond memory of seeing It Follows in the theater, which is another one of my favorites. And seeing this was kind of similar in the sense of just that atmospheric dread of a movie that it can kind of create.
Well, I feel like this and It Follows are two movies that really do a good job of, like, using the entire frame, like the entire, like, you know, widescreen frame. Like, some of my favorite shots in movies are from this one, from Halloween. Like, when she's, like, after she's defeated him, or she thinks she's defeated him in the closet, and she's kind of sitting there, she sent the kids away, and for some reason she doesn't go with the kids. She's like, I'll stay with the killer. You know? And that shot where you just see him out of focus in the background just sit up. Like, to me, that is one of the all-time scary moments in a movie, one of the best shots of a movie, because I feel like Dean Cundey, the cinematographer of this movie, and John Carpenter are so good at using, like, using the entirety of the frame and having stuff in the background or the foreground or left, right, you know. It's just like, it sounds like a stupid thing to say, but it's like, you don't see it. I feel like I don't see that the entirety of a frame used as well as it is in these movies. Like, I feel like that's just such a, one of the key talents I think that Carpenter possessed.
Yeah, just the execution of, like, yeah, I think this is a movie that's kind of serves as a really good example of that, you know, contrasts expert talent versus maybe anything less than expert talent. Is just like, any 100 people could try to do the same thing, but only, you know, a handful, if that, could do it as well as what we actually got. And there are so many shots. Like, I think one of my favorite shots is when, you know, she's peeking over the couch, I think it is, and she's got the knife in her hand. She's, like, really scared, and it's just that, you know, it's basically the couch is like the horizon, really, and she's poking her head over. It's so cool, and it's so, I don't know, it really creates a level of empathy, really, for the character. Like, that kind of connection is just so, like, you feel what they're feeling, and it's just not every, especially people, like, I think, you know, especially for horror fans, you know, you get desensitized after some point with movies, and, you know, things aren't really scary and you're watching for other reasons and everything like that. But this is one of those few movies, I think, that really does still successfully evoke what it's trying to do, despite old it is or how many times you've seen it.
Well, because I feel like, I think the thing that is in this movie's favor is that it holds on things for a long time. It's not cutting around. It gives you a chance to, like, sit in that dread and the tension, you know what I mean? Whereas I feel like a lesser filmmaker nowadays would have taken this basic story that we mentioned and it would just be crap. It would just be like, yeah, we're just gonna have gore, blah, 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 you know. And there's nothing wrong with gore, but I feel like oftentimes a lot of like B-grade horror movies just like, well, we got gore. It's going to be good, right? It's got gore. It's like, well, that's not enough.
I think the gore factor, I think, really was amped up in the 80s. And,
Definitely.
You can definitely see like this movie has a more 70-ish identity, in my opinion.
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, I feel like it doesn't rely, it does have a few jump scares, but I feel like the key thing that makes this movie last and it makes it still scary is that it forces you to sit in these, like you mentioned, that like those shots where you're like in his point of view, and it's like, it just makes you uncomfortable because you're sitting in it for so long and you have like these unbroken takes that go on forever, and it's just like, ugh.
Yeah, it's certainly creepy. One thing that stood out to me the most, I think that I caught this time, that just, you know, had always taken for granted or just didn't register as much as it did this time, was but just the number of times that we actually see Michael Myers before he kills anyone was a lot more than I remembered. So I feel like more movies with like some mysterious killer, they tend to refrain from showing the villain for a very long time, and you only get like little, maybe one shot or some of this. But Michael Myers is a pretty active participant in the movie from the beginning.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Like you mentioned, you see him a lot, and you do. But I like that the movie. It kind of puts him at a distance. You see him in full, but in a lot of the shots before that moment when he strangles Annie and then you just see his mask full on close up in the shot, most of the time you see him at a distance, like especially like when he's just like peeping on Laurie, like, and you see him in full, but like I feel like it's almost like he you see him in full and he's at a distance, and like the movie it does slowly kind of reveal him in a sense, like you don't see his full mask, like, because until he strangles her with the phone, because up until that point he's like kind of, he's either standing behind doors or he's like kind of like in the background, or his mask is somewhat like masked a little bit, like when you see him strangling and I got the names mixed up, when you see him strangling Annie in the car, or is it Linda? I always mix up the names of the characters in this damn movie.
Annie? Linda? Bob?
But with the scene when he's strangling What's-Her-Face in the car, like, you see his mask, but it's like you see it through a fogged-up window. So it's like, you know what I mean? It does and does not sort of reveal him in a way, I think.
No, I think you're right. I think what I felt was that Michael Myers' presence was always there. Whereas definitely. Opposed to, I feel like in maybe movies that are a little bit, you know, more standard, or more common, that balance between presence and awareness of presence. Like, I feel like Michael Myers, even though you're right, he's not like interacting with anyone, he's at a distance or whatever, but the entire movie, you feel him watching or watching the characters and stuff like that. As opposed to another movie that's maybe not showing the villain in any capacity or something like that. It's more like it's a different form of drawing out suspense. Whereas this one, it's like Michael's always around the corner or he's always watching you. You know, I love that shot of him driving the car, right? Where he passes them and then he stops. Like, you're not seeing who he is or anything like that, but you know he's in there. You know he's, you know, feet away from you, yards away from you, and you know you're in danger, or at least we at the audience know they're in danger at that point. So that's very scary.
Can I just say, you mentioned that he's driving next to people. That kid, Tommy, has like no sense of awareness of like his surroundings.
Okay, well, I think it's funny because you mentioned that yesterday, and as you pointed out numerous times, I think that's kind of a thing of all the characters in this movie.
Yes.
They just don't have a very good sense of awareness.
Well, it's in the kids, because the kids by himself, there's nothing going around. There's a car. It's not like this is 1978. So it's not like you could idly drive by a person like you're in a Prius or something, not making any noise. He's in this big old tan station wagon that I'm sure is like, bah, 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 you know,
he just got his pumpkin crushed, dude.
I don't know. I guess he's got he's a lot sad. Of
he's sad. He's just he got bullied by these three older kids telling him about the boogeyman. He's like, he doesn't even know what the boogeyman is. He's got a big old pumpkin that's gone now. It's just like a lot of trouble.
I was going to say, I don't think Tommy's the one that should have known there was a creepy car get driving by him. But for the other people, I'm actually somewhat forgiving that they don't recognize that he's there, because they are so in their own world of just like being horny teens that there's nothing else on their mind. You know what I mean? So like, so they don't notice that there's a creeper standing like, you know, feet behind him on the other side of the back door or something.
Or Loomis not seeing the car.
Well, okay, so if we're going to get into characters that should have noticed things, like, Loomis is the worst offender because, and I got a lot to say about Loomis in this episode because there were some revelations I felt with Loomis in this. Like,
this is really not a Halloween retrospective, it's a Loomis retrospective.
Yes.
You know, everybody's talked about Halloween ad nauseum, so I mean, there's not left much left to say, but Loomis, you know, he hasn't
Yeah, it's like you brought it up, like especially with the first one. I don't know if we really need to go into a plot synopsis of this movie. I think everyone kind of knows. It's like, you know, Michael Myers is a kid, 1963. He's like 6 years old or whatever. He kills his sister. He gets committed for 15 years, and then he escapes and he goes on a kill crazy rampage, and he's pursued by his doctor, Donald Pleasance, who is basically Van Helsing in this movie. But the thing with, there's a few things, and we'll start with the first one you mentioned. Why doesn't he just turn around? Donald Pleasance.
We'll set the stage a little bit because what scene are you talking about? What's going on?
I already mentioned the synopsis. Let's set the scene I'm discussing. So for an undetermined amount of time, I'm assuming a few hours at least, Donald Pleasance, Sam Loomis, is like, I'm pretty sure Michael Myers is going to come back to his house at some point, so I'll just stay outside by the bushes and wait for him. But I will only look in one direction the whole hours I'm here. I will not turn my head and look down the opposite end of the street, because surely Michael Myers is going to come from that part of that side of the street and not that side.
So yeah, he's been camped out, and there is a vehicle behind him that clues him into where Michael Myers might be.
But it's the stolen car. It's the car that Michael stole.
So basically, the problem Dave has is that apparently this car has been parked behind Loomis for hours, and he only notices it.
Turn around. There was what? Yeah, he's there for 3 hours, and suddenly, yeah, it's only after a few hours that Loomis is like, ugh, I'm kind of bored of standing here. I guess I'll slightly turn my head to the left. Oh my god, it's the car! It's just like, how did he not? Surely he must, like, that's another question. Like, it's night when him and the sheriff pull up to the car, and it's after Michael stops the car outside the houses of the babysitters. So it's like, presumably, they would have passed Michael's parked car. Like, what is Loomis doing? Does he not have his glasses? Like, what is happening?
Dave points this stuff out to me, and I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, there's a couple things that happen.
It comes from, like I said, having seen this movie a million times, so it's not like there's a, you know, these are the things that I'm looking at now that I notice because I've seen it a million times, so I'm starting to look for things that maybe I didn't take much note of the first million times I watched this movie.
But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it does seem like he could have just turned around, and I mean, maybe he just didn't notice. Maybe it was the logo. So maybe he thought it was a different logo. So
that must be that other mental institution on the other side of town. It couldn't possibly be the one I go to.
Yeah. But I mean, aside from that, there's not really too much, I mean, continuity errors or anything like that. I wouldn't have caught on to that, but I think you're right.
They would have passed the car, and he should have noticed it. And let's get into further continuity issues or logic issues with Loomis. And I'll just say this right off the top. He is a terrible, and I feel like this has been said on other podcasts I listened to before, but he is a terrible monster hunter. Like, he is just, he's not good at it. He's also a questionable psychiatrist. Like, there's a lot. we haven't, I mean, obviously, we will get to the Rob Zombie movies eventually, but one thing that the first Rob Zombie movie, the remake, does that I actually kind of enjoy is that they dig in a little to Loomis and Michael's time in the sanitarium while he's a kid and basically growing up in this sanitarium, which I think is, that's like the one interesting thing that movie does. It's not touched upon here, and I don't think it's needed, but it does raise the question, though, of like, how good a psychiatrist is he? Because he's basically talking about this guy is pure evil. He has the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. It's like, it makes you wonder what the backstory is with him and Michael.
You fooled him, haven't you, Mike? But not me.
Yeah, he's, I mean, but they do say he tried, what did they say? They say he tried.
I seven tried, eight, I tell you, for tried 7 years. Tried for 7 years. And then I spent another 8 telling him he was evil, and I and saying, like, I'll kill you one day, Michael, oh my God. You know,
Yeah, and the movie really falls apart there because it's well known in psychology it takes 10 years to reach somebody, so he didn't give enough time.
He didn't give him the full time. If he just put in the extra 3 years, maybe he could have gotten through to Michael.
Yeah. But, So I have a question for you. I was saving this question for the podcast, but in the beginning, when Michael escapes from the sanitarium and he breaks into the car, there's a shot where his hand appears and he breaks the window. Mm-hmm. There's like a screwdriver, or not a screwdriver, but a wrench in his hand. Is that supposed to be there, or are we supposed to see that?
I don't think you were really supposed to notice, but it's a little hard to. We watched it in 4K too, so you can kind of see the, you know, the seams and the scotch tape holding things up in certain areas. But that is a wrench that he had in the palm of his hand so that he could break the window.
I know, but like in the movie, is it supposed? Is
no,
it supposed
I don't to think he's supposed he's, to have a wrench. In
he's supposed
his
to be
hand.
That strong, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I've always wondered about that because I've known about that for a while, and then it triggered me to ask you again.
And you thought maybe Michael, it's just instead of just using the wrench like a tool and like breaking it, he puts it in the palm of his hand.
Yeah,
he's psycho, I tell you.
It looks like a card trick. Like the wrench is like in his hand, like he pulls it through his sleeve or whatever. But at the same
before
time,
Michael escaped, he stole a wrench and taped it to his palm.
I mean, he's not opposed to using tools or anything like that.
That's true.
Man wouldn't do that. This isn't a man.
I gotta say, like, speaking of that scene when he breaks out, like, I remember as a kid, that shot of Loomis and the nurse, like, driving up, and then you see, like, the headlights illuminate, like, you know, the other patients, like, in their hospital gowns, and it's just raining and thunder, the music starts up. I remember that scene in particular as a kid always creeped me out, like, big time.
Yeah, it's very, like, Night of the Living Dead-ish.
Yes.
Where they're just kind of like these, because the people that are wandering are, they are just like wandering. They're not like, and it's really dark. It's hard to see. So they're very ghostly. You know,
and like Mike, so you're like, Michael's out there somewhere. You know what I mean? He's one of those people in the gowns. I don't know which, but that makes it more creepy for me.
Yeah. And so, but one thing that you pointed out while we were watching the second one is, you know, his movements, but in this one, he's very, he's not like
he
stiff.
Like glides.
Yeah. He's definitely more agile.
Well, yeah, I feel like this is something that we only really see in this movie, I feel. Like, when he jumps up on the back of that car and he's, like, on top of it, and then, you know what I mean? Like, he's more, I don't know what I would describe him as, but, like, he's, yeah, like, more agile would be a good description, I guess. But, like, the way he moves in this movie, it, like I said, it's like he kind of glides, you know? Like, he's not stiff in this movie. He will get stiff in the sequels for some reason, like a robot. But in this movie, he just sort of glides, and he kind of, like, especially the way he, like, peeps and stuff. Like, when he gets out of the car and he's watching them go, like, you know, Laurie Strode and her friend Annie, like, go to their respective houses across the street to babysit. Like, the way he just sort of, like, holds onto the tree and sort of just peeps. And, like, he only moves this way in this movie. And all the other sequels, he's stiff as a robot. It's interesting.
I think, thinking back, at least for the first two, and contrasting the way he's moving, I think we actually see him physically move as in walk more in the second one as opposed to the first one. So the first one, I think they have this really cool technique going where his movement is established by just where his shadow or figure appears. So there'll be it's not a shot of him necessarily walking a lot, but basically he's behind this tree. Okay, next shot. Now he's behind this car or something like that. So, and then
he just kind of just appear a lot.
Exactly. In the house, like when he attacks people, or same thing with the car, you know, the place where he appears, he's not really like walking too much. He just appears and kills. So like
you see car, like a shadow sort of go across the room or something.
Yeah, so you don't see like that kind of movement that we see in the open that you might see in the next one. So I think that it contributes to that kind of gliding-esque movement nature that you were talking about. And I think it's really cool. It's very well done here because it adds that level of almost otherworldliness to him.
Well, it's the reason why he's referred to as the Shape. You know what I mean? He just sort of like appears or glides around. Talking about that, it's one of those things that makes me kind of wish they never made sequels to this movie. Because, like, I think I might have mentioned this while we were watching it when the credits came up. It's like, imagine if that was the end of this series. There was no series. It was just, he's gone. Loomis looks up. He's like, and the look he has is like, I knew this was going to happen. Like, I knew he couldn't die. And, like, and that's the movie, Halloween. And so the movie ends with those shots of, like, you hear his breathing. And you just see these static shots of everywhere he's been. And it's and the suggestion being, like, he's everywhere. You can't escape him. You can't kill him. Like, that would have been such a good way to just end this movie. Imagine, I feel like this movie would be even more revered than it is now if it had ended with just this movie. You know what I mean? Or if it had just ended in this way.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I guess that is a perspective some people have in not just related to Halloween, but movies in general. Like if you remake it or you make a sequel, it somehow affects the original. And
I guess I just mean like I feel like this. I mean, I guess it already is, but I don't want to. Yeah, you're right. I don't think that any of the sequels cheapen this first movie. This first movie will always exist and it'll always be great. But it's just like I kind of wonder like what the if the opinion of this movie would be even greater or if it'd be talked about in a slightly different way, like academically, if it was just this movie.
I mean, that's a good question. I really don't know, honestly, how I would think people would react to it. But what comes to my mind is almost like we live in a cinematic world where it's almost impossible that this wouldn't get a sequel. I mean, you know, really, Halloween, in terms of the aggregate, is not that different than other horror franchises either. So it's like, you know, I think the big difference is, say, the original Halloween is so, so good as opposed to, like, you know, I don't know if this is controversial, but I think, like, the original Halloween is another league than the original Friday the 13th.
That's not controversial at all. That's so I think we talked about that in the episode we did for Friday the 13th. It's like Halloween is like another class than Friday the 13th. I'm sorry. I love Friday the 13th. It's very dear to me as a series. I grew up with that series, but I can't sit here and say that it's on the same levels as the original Halloween. The original Halloween is a masterpiece.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I think that, because of that, and because of the nature of horror franchises, I mean, or the ease of making a horror franchise. So we've talked about even Final Destination, you know, how the heck is you going to make that a franchise? Well, they still do. And, you know, so it's almost impossible. Just to me, the way I think about the movie business, it's almost impossible that we could live in a world where that wouldn't get a sequel, especially with the ending.
No, you're right. You're right. He's still out there. So he never died. But again, it's just like, I feel like that ending would have so much more weight if they didn't make a bunch of sequels. I guess it's more scary to me somehow that it's just like it's almost that thing where it's like it like your imagination will always be better than anything that they put out. You know what I mean? It's like I feel like I don't know. It's hard to put into words. I don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the Halloween sequels. Like we'll discuss Halloween 2 in the next episode, but it's just like, and I enjoyed that movie, but I just sometimes think like, I wonder how much more weight that ending would have if there were no sequels.
Yeah. And I think that's something that you ask about anytime, some movie franchise proliferates. I mean, you can even extend that conversation to like what's going on with like Star Wars now. You know, I mean, the oversaturation of the same product essentially, can definitely affect you. But I think that's why I think it's important. This is a personal opinion about movie watching, but if you diversify your diet, your movie diet, then you're able to more easily separate yourself from everything else that's going on to what you really love. If that's true about one property. So, you know, I'm not a Star Wars maniac like you. I'm not a Halloween maniac like you. So I watch the ones that you are a maniac. I watch these movies that I really love or whatever. And I'm not like bothered by the other stuff, but I mean, I definitely see where you're coming from. And yeah, I think it would be true. You know, you do have movies, like horror movies. I think, say like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I think, is a really good one where that kind of exists on its own. I mean, there's a remake but both are kind of well regarded, but they're not franchises. Right. So,
yeah.
And they stand on their own as very respected offerings. So, I definitely see where you're going with that.
Well, I think part of it goes into like with Star Wars, it's like, yeah, I get it. Like that is a whole world. There's a whole lot of stuff you can mine from that universe, like characters, whatnot. But with Halloween, it's so specific. It's just this guy. And when you get into sequels, it's like you can either do what Halloween 3 does and make it go a completely different direction, turn it like into an anthology type thing where every Halloween sequel's a new story, which they didn't do. Or you can do what Halloween 2 did, and it's like, well, why is he doing this? And I think that's the big problem I have with the sequels in general. It's like the reason and I've said this before, and it's been said to death, because like I'm sure we mentioned this, like Halloween is one of probably the most discussed, you know, movies in the horror genre. So everything that's been said has been said, or that could be said has been said. But it's just like I think the reason that the sequels are not needed is because the reason the first movie works is that he has no motive. He just snaps, and that's what makes it scary. So when you get Halloween 2 and the sequels, and they get into like, and I guess we'll get into this more when we talk about Halloween 2, but when they start getting into why he kills, like I feel like it cheapens it. And that's kind of I think the biggest knock I have against the sequels. It's like, that's what made the first one great, is that he didn't have a motive, and that's when they kind of screw it up. That said, I still enjoy the sequels for what they are, but it's just like, I don't know.
No, I get that completely. I mean, I think you're right, and you've said it many, many times about the absence of motive is really a huge component of the driving force and power.
It's what makes him the shape, really.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it extra scary, right? And it's like, it reminds me of, I don't know if you like this movie, but the Strangers, you know,
I need to rewatch it.
One of the scariest moments in that movie was that there's a part where the victims they ask the strangers, you know, why they're doing this. And then they just say, because you were home. And it's like that absence of motive is just so, so scary.
Because you don't know what the hell these people are going to do.
Yeah, it's like the, you know,
what they intend to do with you.
Your life is on the line and you have no idea why. Like, what could be scarier? I think you're absolutely right. And we'll talk about the sequel more when we get there. But as it stands, you know, I mean, and maybe it's because I've watched it a lot less times than you have, but I was able to kind of forget everything while I was watching this and just be isolated to what we were seeing. And it was like, I wasn't worried about, I wasn't worried about that. They did explain it later on. It was just, I was watching it in a vacuum really. So, And I think I didn't once, you know, actually there was a moment where towards the end, you know, when it's basically Laurie versus Michael, and it's like, it was like, oh yeah, they haven't said why he's trying to do this. Like, it's just, this is, you know,
he's just, the boogeyman.
Yeah. He's the boogeyman.
That's the reason why.
Yeah. So,
and again, that's why I think this, and you mentioned in a vacuum, like I feel like Loomis's portrayal in this movie is unique. And we mentioned before that Loomis is crazy, and then it's like, he's evil, this and that. It's like, watching it with you, I had a realization. I'm like, I don't think he's quite that crazy in the first movie. Like, I don't think Loomis's real craziness happens until the second movie.
Are you talking about Loomis or Michael Myers?
Loomis. Because I feel like the general idea of Sam Loomis's character, the way Donald Pleasance plays him, is that, Michael, he's evil. Michael, stop. It's like, we have to get, you know what I mean? But in this movie, he's very, like, relatively reserved, I feel. Like, he's kind of quiet. I mean, there are moments, like, when he's talking with, like, the guy who runs the institution, of just like, I told everybody, you know what I mean? But, like, I feel like when he's talking to the sheriff, he's very much quiet, and, like, he's definitely in Van Helsing mode, but it's more just, like, is it just me? Like, he just seemed a lot more quiet and reserved, and the craziness of Loomis, like, when he's just like, there's that evil everywhere, ah! That doesn't come until, like, the second movie after Michael has, like, after he's seen that Michael has survived six shots and got up, you know what I mean?
So it's interesting you say that, because I wasn't thinking about that specific moment, but I think it ties into something I was thinking about when I was watching the second one. But I mean, it's appropriate to bring up in either conversation. But there is a distinct difference between the first and the second, and I think it's directly attributable to John Carpenter. And
I think that
kind of Donald Pleasance's performance in the first Halloween, to me, is closer in tone to Prince of Darkness in terms of dread, as opposed to outright, like, mania.
Well, because it feels like it's like he knows, like I mentioned, like when he looks down after he shot him and he sees that he's gone, like it's not like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It's like he knew that was going to happen.
Well, I don't. So the way I took it was that he didn't know that was going to happen, but he wasn't surprised.
He wasn't surprised.
Because I think if he knew, then he wouldn't have wasted any time, and he would have ran over straight to the dang window or whatever, balcony or whatever. Yeah. But I think, I think John Carpenter has always been really good about, well, atmosphere in general, but building dread and, like, making you think the devil is coming. So whether it's Halloween, Prince of Darkness, The Fog, The Thing, these are all expert, you know, level movies that kind of create dread and atmosphere. And I think Donald Pleasance, this is one example that I would point to where Donald Pleasance's performance actually, like, fosters this dread from Michael Myers. You know, the devil is here, the boogeyman is here. And I think that's a departure that the second one does take. And that's one reason I would point to Halloween and say, this is why it's so good, because everything from Donald Pleasance's character to a number of other things create this really scary, world.
Well, and so his performance also, he brings like a certain resignation to it. Like where he's just like, I know he's, it's more like, it's not, it's less, he's evil, and more just like, he's evil, and, it's almost like he has, like, a Morgan Freeman in Seven type of attitude towards Michael Myers in the first movie, where, and it, like, it makes me think, like, Loomis is probably, like, if Michael Myers' evil like this could exist in the world, like, what hope is there for us? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like he just has that, like, sort of, resignation in it, where he's just like, oh my God, like, what kind of world would create something like Michael Myers? Like, we're all doomed, you know what I mean? But it's not, he's not like screaming it from like the top of a bell tower in the first movie. In this one, he's more just like, it's like, it's almost like he's had to live with this knowledge for 8 years, you know what I mean? And he realized he couldn't get through to Michael Myers, and so he's like 8 years, like, I gotta keep this thing under containment the best I can, because it's like, I can't let this evil out into the world, you know?
In some ways, I mean, it makes a lot of sense with the way his character is written, because if he is, you know, the psychologist tasked with Michael Myers, who is this evil thing, you know, and if it's all true and all checks out, then he would be a character who is basically like beat down and has been like protecting humanity
for 8 years.
Yeah, for 8 years, you know. I mean,
it's also a thing where he's just like, he's told people about this, but like only really he knows, because no one really believes. Like, he's not evil, you know what I mean? He's not the devil. Like, but people are telling Loomis, but Loomis is like, so he's carried this knowledge for 8 years, and that's why in this particular movie, the first one, he's just like, he's just like saddled with this burden of knowing that this exists almost and trying to contain it. It's just interesting seeing his performance in this compared to the sequels.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a definite strength in this one, because it just adds to the overall, I don't know, I think it adds to Michael's character in a sense too, because it's clearly like Michael's existence has worn down Loomis, because he does feel like he does come across as a guy who's defeated, in a way already when he's introduced. Yeah. And so, like even the beginning conversation with him and the nurse in the car, he's like, yeah, we're going to sedate him. And, he almost has this tone like, you know, he's just keeping evil at bay in a sense. And so,
like, he knows it can never truly die type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So he's basically doing like, he almost acts like his efforts are futile.
Especially his face in the car. He's just, you know what I mean? He's just like, he doesn't want to move him. He's like, well, he's been here for 8 years. It seems like this is the best option. It's like, but now they want to move him or somewhere. It's just like that's one of the best acting in the movie. And he's not even really doing anything. It's just like, he's just kind of, you know, his face in the car is just like this, just downtrodden face, just like having to deal with this for 8 years, knowing that this is a guy is evil. And now they're transferring him. It's almost just like, I got to wonder if Loomis is like, he expects things to go wrong with this transfer. You know what I mean?
I'm sure, you know, thinking about his character, I don't know if he expected it at that particular time, but he knew something would happen at some point, because obviously he also walks around with like a lot of like shame because people don't listen to him. It feels like this part of the both films kind of blends together, but he's constantly told that it's his fault.
Well, yeah, and there are some things in Halloween 2 that you could, he becomes a different character almost in Halloween 2. He snaps in the beginning of Halloween 2, and he becomes a different character. And like you said, it might go into a little bit John Carpenter not directing the movie anymore and giving him a specific direction. But it seems like we're kind of like, we're really itching to get into Halloween 2. is there anything else with Halloween 1 that you wanted to mention specific to the first movie?
Well, I mean, I don't think we said this before, but it's a pretty good movie.
Oh, there were a couple things in my notes I wanted to bring up. I would say, as far as like slight knocks against this movie, there is one scene that is a little bit on the nose, I think. It's specifically when Laurie is in class and she notices Michael Myers' car across the street and he's staring at her. What the dialogue is that's happening in this moment from the teacher, where she's like,
"But what Samuels is really talking about here is fate. You see, fate caught up with several lives here. No matter what course of action Collins took, he was destined to his own fate, his own day of reckoning.
You see, fate always catches up with you." Like, this teacher's delivery is so, like, on the nose. You know what I mean? It's just, it's like, this is the theme of the movie. Are you listening? You know? It's just, like, even as a kid, I was just like, you know, who wasn't knowledgeable with the themes of movies or anything. I was just watching movies on a surface level as a young kid. Like, even as a kid, I was like, this is a little on the nose, isn't it?
Foreshadowing.
I was they might as well have done like a Jean-Luc Godard thing and you know, like have like a big title card in big bold letters say, "Fate, fate, fate." You know what I mean?
Oh, then it would have been a perfect movie.
Like, it's one of the few things about like the first Halloween movie, other than like the inescapable things of like a low budget, that it's like that I kind of ding the movie for, but it's like, it's fine. But it is kind of, I'm like, damn, they couldn't have been more on the nose with that dialogue.
So one thing I wanted to make sure we talked about, because it was mind boggling when you pointed it out when we were watching the movie, I don't know if you have it in your notes, but the part where the boyfriend and or the two kids that are fooling around, they talk about the other girl.
Oh, Lindsay. So yeah, Linda and Bob, or is it Annie? And I can't freaking remember. I always mix those two up. I think it's Linda and Bob. They pull up like in their stoner van, and they're who knows how many beers in, driving around the town. And there's a bit of dialogue. There's an exchange that they have where they're like, "Okay, so we're going to go upstairs. I'll tear your clothes off. You tear my clothes off. And then we'll tear Lindsay, the little girl's clothes off, which is just like, how drunk are you?
Okay, so we're gonna do, first we go inside, right? Then we'll just talk a little, and then Annie will distract Lindsay. That's when we go upstairs to the first bedroom on the left. You got it?
Okay, first I rip your clothes off.
Don't rip my blouse, it's expensive, idiot.
Then you rip my clothes off, then we rip Lindsay's clothes off. Yeah, I think I got it.
Totally.
I got, okay, so this is like, this was when Dave pointed this out to me, I was not
comprehending. You were floored.
I was not comprehending what you were saying, because I couldn't believe that that was in this movie. Like, it's not even for like the 70s.
You thought the name, like, they mentioned was like their friend or something.
Yeah, I thought it was the babysitter. Annie or Anne or Annie. That's who I thought they were talking about. And so
I had to rewind it.
that's how drastic this was in our.
You didn't believe me. I was just like, no, Lindsay is the little girl that Annie is babysitting, and you're like, no. It's like, I'll remind it.
Well, this is not maybe as well known as other things about me, but I'm really terrible with names, both in real life and in movies. And so I wasn't sure. I was like, that can't be right. Right. It's just like, they have to be talking about the older girl, like that. That is their age, but it's, I mean, sure enough, we verified it. We did our fact checking. So I mean, they do this. I just got to imagine that's an error in the script, but I mean, I'm just giving everyone a,
no, I think out. Bob's just a freak.
That's so, it's too gross for people to not be aware.
It's one of those things. It's like, how did people react like in 1978 in the audience? Like,
well, I'm pretty sure most people are like me and don't catch it because we're not.
Expecting a line like that.
Well, we're not expecting it. And who the heck is going to remember the name of the little girl? Like, they don't. She's not even like in the main house. I think most people, maybe this is just me trying to defend myself, but I'm like, are not paying attention to the names like that, especially that level of names, and are just assuming he's talking about their friend. Because it makes more sense if they're talking about their friend, who's also the babysitter.
It's bizarre. It makes me like, John, what was that all about? I mean, it could be a thing. It could be like a slasher thing where it's just like, let's make this character so deplorable that you're not upset when he dies.
That's more of
a Friday the 13th thing.
That feels like something in another movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a number of other horror films, it wouldn't be as surprising. But a movie like this just seems like this movie is not only just like a good horror movie, but it's a really good movie in general. Like it surpasses the trappings of the genre, I think. And it's one of the best examples of it. And I think it's because of things not like this. Like, this is exactly why I wouldn't expect something like that to be in this movie, just because everything else is so well thought out and well made. It's just almost like, so that's why I was like, it has to be a mistake. So, but yeah, so Dave pointed out and I was just like mind boggled.
There was another thing that happened, and I feel like, again, this has probably been brought up in other, like, people who talked about this movie, but there's the whole scene when Annie is making popcorn. So there's a few layers here. There's not just the first one, which I'll get into, but there's another layer, which I don't know if a lot of people mention, but she spills butter on herself, and it looks like she just spills a little bit of butter, like, on her chest or something, or on her shirt.
No, no, I just made a mess of myself. I gotta call you back. Oh, yuck!
Lindsay, I need a rope!
It looks like she peeled it on her pants to me, but that's why it was so bonkers that she kept...
To tell, because you're looking at her from Michael's point of view from behind, so you just see her back. So you're not exactly sure how much butter she got on herself, but whatever amount of butter it was, it couldn't have been enough to necessitate her taking off all of her clothes. It's just like, it's one thing that's always baffled me about this movie. It's not a knock on the movie, but it's just like a character motivation thing where it's just like, why would you take off all your clothes? Why wouldn't you just like do the thing that most people do, just get like a wet paper towel and like dab at it or something? Like, how much butter could she have possibly spilled on herself?
Well, this movie, okay, so there's a couple little breadcrumbs of things that happen in this movie. Like, this is a perfect example, which for me prevent it from being what I would call a perfect movie, but it's like this moment, and then the other moment is when she gets trapped in the laundry room and she gets stuck in the window, and it's like a porn setup, like with the way she's trapped in the window, and it's just
with
like
her butt out.
Yeah, it's just, and the way it's shot too. I mean, it's one thing to get stuck, but the way it's shot too is just like, okay, come on. It's just less. Like I said, in a normal B movie, it wouldn't have been anything to sneeze at, but it just stood out to me. It's like, really? I mean, it just seems immature, I guess.
Now promise me you won't tell anybody about this.
Well, something else that stood out to me is the second layer I was getting to, and this is a bit I don't know if a lot of people mention when they're talking about this moment. But so she takes off all her clothes and she's like, I got to do laundry now. I got an undetermined amount of butter on myself, on my pants or my clothes. It's not shown. So I'm going to do some laundry, throw this stuff in the laundry. What we see, and I never noticed this until this viewing, but you see her like shaking laundry detergent on her clothes. The problem is she's doing this right next to the popcorn. It's like, and for the longest time, I always thought that she was shaking like some salt on something, like preparing something, but the popcorn's right there in the bowl. It's ready to go. But she has like this big old box of laundry detergent that she's shaking out all this detergent on that's literally like an inch away from the popcorn that she's about to serve to this little girl. It's like, this little girl can't catch a break. Like, she's trying to get, like, she's probably going to get poisoned by her babysitter or, like, molested by her babysitter's friends. It's just like, this girl can't catch a break.
Poor Lindsay.
Poor Lindsay. Like, if she's not almost getting killed by her babysitter, she's getting killed by some maniac, you know? It's just like.
What's the, and then the, Tommy's in danger, too. And Tommy's the one.
Well, because
who...
for some reason, like the Annie's like, say, Lindsay, you want to watch the movie across the street with Tommy Doyle? Lindsay's like, yes. And that's another thing that's never really brought up. It's like, I guess she knows Tommy and likes him, I guess.
Well, yeah. So I read that this time too, and I was like, that was weird. I
Tommy Doyle.
Well, if they are neighbors, then maybe they're just friends. So I don't know. That...
Oh, that's of course they're neighbors. All right.
Yeah, so
because it's not like Lindsay like is driven to that house and is staying there, like that's her house.
Yeah, they live across the true that's residence, right. Tommy and Lindsay, they live across the street from one another, so
okay. I
mean, they probably play.
Yeah, they're probably friends or something. Okay. I'll allow it.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. But yeah, that was funny. We caught the detergent thing, and it's kind of just a funny moment because it's like, God, this babysitters suck. Like, they're
well,
just
the way that
so
the way that she's haphazardly shaking this detergent out, I'm like, some of that detergent got on that popcorn. I'm sorry. The way she was haphazardly like shaking it out, I'm like, and that's another thing. She shakes again. How much butter could she have possibly spilled on herself? She is shaking so much detergent on her clothes, and then later when she puts her clothes in the washer, she puts more detergent in there. What are you doing? That is a disproportionate amount of detergent compared to the stain that may or may not exist.
Well, one day if we ever meet John Carpenter, you can ask him about why he used so much detergent in those scenes.
Yeah, I'll ask him. I won't phrase it though as like being related to the movie. I'll just be like, "Hey, John, I'm curious. How much detergent do you use on a load of laundry?" I won't even like mention Halloween. He'll just be like, "What?" Security? Anyway, wanted to bring that up because I for the longest time I thought she was shaking salt on something, but I'm like, wait a minute, the popcorn's off to the side. She's not shaking salt on popcorn. She's shaking detergent on her clothes. Anyway, that was all. Did you have any other notes?
I think that's it.
Well, alrighty. That'll do it for the first installment of the Apocalypse Video Halloween Retrospective. Halloween will not die. It keeps going on. It's Shocktober all year long. We'll be back next time with another terrifying installment. We'll be back with more of The Night He Came Home with Halloween 2.
First I rip your clothes off, then you rip my clothes off, then we rip Lindsay's clothes off. Yeah, I think I got it.
Totally.